Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav, in for David Martin Davies. In 2009, the Affordable Care Act made what many people characterized as a modest proposal, trying to mandate repayments for doctors who talk to and counsel patients about advanced directives and end-of-life care. Advocates said it offered a voluntary incentive to fully inform patients about the human cost of their treatments and offered options. Critics of the program, largely from the right, had big concerns. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin was rallying people behind the idea that the decisions regarding end-of-life care would be taken from individuals and given to the government in the form of death panels. Writing on her Facebook page, the one-time vice presidential candidate lamented that her own son, who is cognitively disabled, might be dispatched by such a panel of doctors who would deem him unworthy of care. The repayment plan was scrapped in the Senate. Of course, the idea was patently false, found by PolitiFact to be the lie of the year, but being true and going viral are not mutually exclusive, and that whopper got around. According to Pew, 86% of people surveyed knew something about the death panels. Last week, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services proposed payments for end-of-life and advanced care directives once again. It's known that the end-of-life decisions are difficult to think about, let alone talk about with doctors and loved ones, but how much more difficult did that death panel label make it, and what should we expect now that the deal is back on the table? This is a conversation we need our listeners involved in. What are your stories of end-of-life decisions? Are you facing some extreme treatment that is forcing you to think about an advanced directive? Have you dealt with the death of a loved one recently, maybe an older parent? Tell us about the experience by calling 210-614-8980. Did you have the conversation or didn't you? And if not, do you wish you had? Joining us to talk about this in studio is Dr. Jason Morrow, a palliative care specialist and medical ethicist working for University Health System and the UT Health Science Center. Welcome back, Jason. And also joining us on the line is Don Shoemaker, CEO of National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. Don, thanks for making the time.
Sure. Good afternoon.
So, Don, go ahead and tell us what this proposal, the current proposal, does and what it doesn't do.
What it does do is offer the opportunity for every American over the age of 65 to have a conversation with their physician about what their choices might be should they come to the end of their life or when they come to the end of their lives. And the payment for this now will be paid directly for by Medicare, which would go to that individual physician. The difficulty that I've been doing hospice work now for many years, hospice and palliative care work for many years, the difficulty is that people wait a very long period of time before they have these conversations with their family members, and oftentimes they're trying to make a decision about the middle of a crisis. So we advocate very strongly that people fill out their advance directives, let their family know what it is that they want, and this new legislation will encourage and help the physicians and the patients to have these conversations before it's a time in their life where they're actually going to have to do something to use it.
So, Jason, you're a doctor working on the front lines of this issue. What do you think of this proposal? And also, before we started, you said that it was a bit of a surprise. Why was it a surprise? And tell me what you think.
Well, politically, the context from 2009 has not changed dramatically. I'm not sure that the legislative and political environment is more hospitable at this time for change in social insurance or other aspects of medical care. As recently as 2 weeks ago, Representative Mo Brooks, a Republican from Alabama, said that the Affordable Care Act will decide whether a group of people live or die. And, quote, they're going to tell you to get your affairs in order because they're not going to cover you and you're going to die. So the fear-mongering is still there. What does give me optimism, or what did as of late 2014, was that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services up in Maryland issued a final rule that did approve two new practice billing codes. Now, those, as you point out, did not yet provide for a reimbursement mechanism, but that's what's on the table now. And if it goes through the approval process, which includes public commentary, then it can be implemented as soon as January 1. But Don makes a great point that medical decision making, whether it's at the beginning of life, in the course of chronic illness, or at the end of life, is always harder in the context of crisis, where there's emotions that run high, fear, anger, guilt, as well as the symptoms and burden of illness and the stress of family dynamics and social factors. So it's always best to try to elicit preferences and discuss the course of illness prior to experiencing a crisis. And that's why it's so important for doctors to talk to their patients about their medical illness in the more calm context of a clinic visit. But unfortunately, until this proposal, doctors simply are not I repeat, not paid to talk to their patients. And if they're not paid or reimbursed for practices, then it's hard to change the culture and encourage them to do so.
Well, I'm interested, Don Shoemaker, Jason had touched on it, saying that, yes, it is. It's necessary to incentivize this. Why is it necessary? Why aren't doctors already talking about it? Is this a subject that non-palliative specialists avoid?
Not necessarily. The physicians are talking about these issues with their patients quite a bit. But what this legislation will do, or this regulation will do, it'll allow physicians to get paid for it to provide this conversation, to have this conversation without the patient having to go into the office to have a medical consultation because of a medical issue and medical problem. So the difference really is this is essentially a new service that Medicare is going to be paying for the primary care physician or the caring physician to have the conversation with that patient, to set out what the advance directives are, to make sure that the patient and the family are aware of everything and that they are all in sync, because, and I'm sure my co-presenter knows this very well, there's nothing worse than a family fighting over the deathbed of a patient because one daughter thinks that they want to do this and another daughter thinks that they want to do that. The physician to have the opportunity to have these discussions, have it all down in your advance directive, just affords everybody a better outcome when the time comes, and the time will come for everybody listening to this radio station.
Well, Jason, I'm interested in that aspect. Talk about how difficult it is. Tell people, you know, when you don't have the person cognizant to make the decision and you have to go to family members who haven't talked about it, what do you go through?
Oh, well, the emotions are intense and they run deep. As the Institute of Medicine pointed out in 2014 in Dying in America, the underlying principle that we need to acknowledge in healthcare is that we are all going to die and we are likely to get the outcomes that our system produces. If our healthcare system is designed only towards curative care and rescue care with high technology and the momentum that comes with that, then we tend to neglect that dying is a part of life. And we neglect those who are suffering through the later stages of illness. And it is extremely important to acknowledge that there are other values and other goals to achieve beyond immortality and fighting forever at all costs. There's also autonomy. People are allowed to make decisions about their own health care, and if they are informed about the course of their illness, then they can express themselves in advance, and their wishes can be respected by their family. And as Don points out, this can help the family from tearing each other apart as they speculate about what your wishes are. Rather than saying, I'm giving up on Dad, they can say, I'm doing what Dad wanted. Dad did not want to live on a machine with no mental functioning, only to incur extra costs that would burden his family. Let's honor the autonomy of the individual and emphasize that healthcare is more about promoting what an individual autonomy perspective would recommend rather than giving up on resources that might be wasted and not successful anyways.
Real quickly, I mean, you mentioned it already. Emotions are high. Are people just misremembering? They're all remembering some other, you know, some kind of half conversation they had with their parent, with their loved one, and is how often is disagreement?
Well, if you don't write it down, it's not clear, and there's always disagreement.
Correct.
And people always round up. They feel guilty and accountable and responsible for making these decisions. But that's why, as a parent or as an American, when you have a family, if you put your wishes in writing, then you're giving a gift to them.
We're talking about end-of-life conversations, their importance. Call in with your stories of end-of-life care and advanced directives and decision-making under duress. We'll take your calls, 210-614-8980. I'm Paul Flav. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav. We're talking about the government funding or repaying doctors who have conversations about end-of-life care and advanced directives with their parents and the impact that misinformation, notably the death panel label, has had on these conversations. I want to get to a call. Valerie's called in. She called 210-614-8980. Valerie, you're on the air. What's your thought?
Hi. Well, I think it's fantastic to have some help at the end. In my situation, my mother had a heart attack, and an ambulance took her to Methodist Hospital, and she subsequently had a surgery there. I was standing right there, and the doctor had this paper, and I was supposed to decide right there if she was going to have a surgery or not. And I want to tell you, there was nobody else to talk to. It was just my decision. And she died in surgery. And so I wish I had had some second opinion or somebody to talk to, somebody to suggest, hey, you know, if you want to, you don't have to medically intervene. You know, you can take your mom home, and she might do just fine for a while. So, you know, I just didn't have anybody to talk to at all and was under pressure to make a decision quickly. So they're very busy.
Valerie,
both are very busy.
Thank you so much for calling in. I'm so sorry for your loss, but it does offer an opportunity. Don Shoemaker, did you have a response to that?
Well, Valerie, and I'm sorry, again, for what you went through. This is not an unusual happening, however, in our country. And people oftentimes, when there is not something written down on paper, are left to their own devices to figure out what mom would have wanted, what you feel as though you have to make a decision about. And these unresolved conversations cast very long shadows in families' lives. Oftentimes, people remember for the rest of their lives what they did say, what they didn't say, what they wished would have happened, wish somebody had stepped in to help them during that moment. And it's incredibly, in many ways, demanding emotional work that has to be done, because you're still trying to figure out, did you do the right thing 10, 15 years later? So I'm hoping that you're doing okay with this and that you're getting some support if you need it, just knowing going forward that these conversations will ultimately help everybody not have the same experience.
I'm interested in going back in time real briefly. You know, Don, take us back to 2009. Your organization was probably really excited to see this provision in the ACA that was going to, you know, mandate repayments for these kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. And then you had to go through this strange rumor mill going on about it, and then ultimately it died in the Senate. Take us back there, and what was that like?
It was very frustrating. We had done a lot of work with folks on working on the ACA legislation. We were over on the Hill quite a bit. We had gotten a lot of support from Congress. And as I think was mentioned just a little bit earlier, an unelected public official began to make a lot of noise about this opportunity for people, and they characterized it in the term of the government was going to be paying for death panels in order to decide whether or not you as an American citizen was going to have the right to live or die. And there's nothing in the legislation even remotely resembling that. This is an opportunity for a physician to get paid for to provide a comprehensive conversation with their patient, which is something that every American has a right to have. So it was very demoralizing. We actually saw this morning, we're having our policy day on the Hill today. Senator Warner was with us this morning, and we were talking about the success going forward of proposed new legislation that he's sponsoring and the Medicare legislation as being very, very positive outcomes of this very, very difficult conversation.
Jason Morrow, you had something to add?
Yeah, I think it's important for Valerie to know, and I think for the listening public to know in terms of the general practice of counseling about end-of-life wishes, is that the purpose here is to inform family members so they can make better choices about their care. Their physicians, even in Valerie's situation, if you had a second perspective, would not have instructed her what to do. That's not informed consent. Informed consent is understanding the risks, the benefits and alternatives, the values at stake, and helping you help your family member make a decision that's consistent with known values. And the Affordable Care Act, the counseling sessions, that's all they are, is helping understand where your course of illness might lie, the decisions you might face, and help you interpret those decisions in light of your own values. And it's sad to see that our legislatures confuse the practice of having reimbursed counseling sessions with the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which was created by the Affordable Care Act. As you know, Medicare and social insurance, there's a long history of figuring out how to control costs. And I'm sure anybody who makes the statement about, well, let's control costs themselves could be called a death panel. But the fact is that we've got to achieve some sort of cost control so that we can continue to give better care for more people over time. The Independent Payment Advisory Board exists. It's not the same as counseling sessions. It's just a mechanism where the actuary, the chief actuary for Center for Medicare and Medicaid, has to determine if the growth rate for Medicare is going too high. If so, then the advisory board then issues a plan to help control costs. And you know what? If the advisory board doesn't do it, and this is part of the ACA, then the Secretary of Human Health and Services has to issue a plan. And if she does not or he does not, then whose desk does it stop at? It stops at Congress. So if you wanted to make the argument that death panels are involved, then you'd have to say it applies to anybody who's trying to promote quality care while also controlling costs. But let's be clear, the advisory board and the Health and Human Services and the Congress who try to control costs is simply a different mechanism than the counseling sessions, although both are part of a way of promoting quality care while also respecting individual choices.
Jason Morrow works for the UT Health Science Center as a palliative care specialist. Don Schumacher is CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. We're talking about, you know, what people hate to talk about, the end of our lives and the treatment that we can get or won't get or need to get or don't need to get based on what our wishes are at the end of life, and the government's proposed repaying doctors for having those conversations. Jason, I'm interested in getting, you know, your take on the front lines of it regarding, you know, what did that mean when you saw what you do and take very seriously, you know, as a profession turned into kind of a sideshow to defeat this larger, you know, this larger conversation about the ACA?
Well, it's hard not to feel defeatist when something that is so difficult to talk about over a period of decades, since the early 1970s, late 60s, over a period of decades starts to gain momentum as being accepted not only as standard of medical care, but as something that can be discussed in a public forum. And then with one fell swoop and one really clever phrase, it all goes drops so far back. But you know what? The strength and the sincerity and the integrity of the practice of doctors talking to patients is so true and so valid that you can see 6 years later the context changes just a little bit. And I guess I'd like to point out, you know, thinking about those front lines, what the adult children of parents really struggle with is making decisions about not just surgery, but foregoing life-sustaining measures. And what I routinely counsel people on is that there are many different goals of medical care. There's prolonging life at all costs, but there's also being healthy. There's also being functional and independent in your life, which may or may not be consistent with living as long as possible. There's comfort, there's dignity, and there's peace, and there's not being a burden on one's family. All of these are legitimate goals of healthcare. Our system is designed to talk only about the technology and let's do more. And that's why this type of practice is just one toe in the water. One way, as Don points out, it may actually be consistent with what doctors want to do, but it's a way to incentivize a more comprehensive approach to healthcare. What people are really clamoring for, something that includes not just technology, but also real on-the-ground, value-based, patient-centered healthcare.
I want to get to a call. Frank is called in. 210-614-8980 is the number. Frank, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thanks for calling in.
Good. Yeah. All I really wanted to say was the hospital system that I go to here, the University Hospital System, excellent. They do everything right about 99% of the time. It was until maybe 2-3 years ago I finally got a little frustrated, and I told the doctors and anybody who was willing to listen, just tell me the rules. Explain the rules to me. And it's like pulling teeth, you know? It's either they know or they don't know or they don't want you to know. Do you guys follow me on my complaint here?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that was it. Now I'll listen to your answer, gentlemen.
Thanks, Frank. Don, go ahead.
Well, I think that that's also a very common experience. When you're in the middle of a medical crisis, you do very much depend on your physician and the medical team surrounding you to support your decision-making and certainly to understand all of the ramifications of your illness and of the treatment. Sometimes I think it's very difficult for physicians, especially when the patient is in the middle of a medical crisis, to have the conversation in such a way that they feel comfortable with and the patient feels comfortable with and can understand. The difficulty is that you are oftentimes trying to make decisions in a very, very quick fashion, in a very deliberate way, certainly, but also in a very confusing way, because communicating the appropriate information can be very, very difficult. What this gentleman is saying, which I think is absolutely correct, going back to what we were talking about earlier, had he had the opportunity to have these conversations with the hospital team, as well as probably administration if he needed to do, he probably would have gotten more answers rather than questions in terms of making his own planning for going forward with his medical care. So, you know, it happens everywhere, every day in this country, and I think the opportunity for change is to, again, not wait until the last minute to have it done. Make sure that's done, the conversations are had, and you've written it down so nobody has a question.
You know, I'm interested, we're wrapping up here, but I saw when this first was announced, I think a lot of us expected the same fever pitch, the same kind of of allegations to come out. It's been largely mute from the side of the aisle that was talking about death panels and the like. Is that what you're seeing, Jason Morrow?
Well, I get some trickles of heat in the media, but I think on the ground level, because the Affordable Care Act really has this fait accompli, it's really implemented and looks like that's where we're going, this sort of proposal is the sort of thing that's likely to be accepted. We have the momentum of the Affordable Care Act, and we also have the fact that the way the Center for Medicare and Medicaid is laying this out, there's going to be a public discussion session in the coming months. We may see some fur flying, but I think in the end of the day, January 1, these things are going to go live.
And Don, do you think that we're on the right track?
We're absolutely on the right track, and I agree with my fellow commentator. We are actually in a very different place than we were in 2009, and I think that while there may be some fur that's going to fly, for the most part, I think you're going to find tremendous support on the Hill. We've been dealing in conversations with both the Republicans and the Democrats since this has come out, and there's a general sense that this is going to go forward, so I think we're going on the right path.
Don Shoemaker works for he's the CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. Jason Morrow works for the UT Health Science Center as a palliative care specialist. We've been talking about end-of-life decisions on The Source. Thanks, guys, for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, no problem. I'm Paul Flav. This has been The Source. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flav and David Martin Davies. Our engineer is Doug DeMore. Management and oversight provided by News Director Shelley Koffler and VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.